You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, October 3rd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Glenn Greenwald on America's assassinating of an American citizen because they're a bad guy. Or I should say, that person was a bad guy. How do we know? He was assassinated. And we only assassinate bad guys who deserve it. Also on the program, our man on Wall Street, Jeff, gave us a report on Friday. He was part of just an amazing Occupy Wall Street over the past 3 or 4 days. Has just become, it's just grown leaps and bounds. 10,000 people down at Zuccotti Park on Friday. Another 3,000 or 5,000 there on Saturday. 700 arrests on Saturday on the Brooklyn Bridge. Jeff will fill us in, as will our own Matt, who was also there on Friday, at the very least. Also on the program today, turns out, I know this is really hard to believe, but the Koch brothers, it's really amazing when you think that someone... two individuals who are so against government regulation, so against government law, would actually, try and break and skirt the law by, say, making money by trying to get around a ban on economic dealings with Iran and bribing foreign officials. And in fact, I haven't even gotten through the entire Bloomberg piece. You know those hippies over at Bloomberg, those hippies at the Bloomberg News, with their hippie charges. So like a 35-page story, but just in the first couple of pages, it sounds like the Koch brothers have broken many, many laws. Not shocking, and of course Rick Perry. This is just in. Racist douchebag. Who could have known? How could you have possibly guessed? And of course, whose fault is it? Well, of course, it's Herman Cain's fault that he's so racist. That, according to redstate.org bloggers, we will, or commenters, I should say. You can't control what comments are on your site. I understand that. But, it is interesting to see what they're saying out there in the blogosphere. Also, the statewide mortgage deal, chance for immunity for the fraudulent bankers, that seems to be in the toilet now. California has left that deal. We will get to all these stories and a Scott Walker boondoggle. But first, we will take a break, and then we will talk to Glenn Greenwald about this sort of milestone that we've reached. That even a father going to court to try and get the American government to not assassinate his son couldn't stop. We'll be right back with Glenn Greenwald after this.
Love.
All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome Glenn Greenwald, best-selling author and the writer at salon.com, I guess, and revamped site.
Exciting, isn't it?
Yes, I could. Yes, it's always exciting. We're trying to do a revamp here. It's always just a huge pain for about 6 weeks, and then it all becomes...
6 weeks, you realize nothing really improved, and you don't know why you went through all that.
Right, that's what I'm saying. After 6 weeks, it's completely obsolete again, and you're just waiting for the next redesign.
Exactly.
So, Glenn, there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk to you about, but the most important of which, you know, which of course is getting traditional treatment from the mainstream media. Eh, it's just, you know, another day when we assassinate an American citizen. Tell us the story of Anwar al-Awlaki, and tell us the basic background of the story.
Well, we begin with the fact that al-Awlaki is an American citizen. Media reports haven't really made that clear. They've been describing him as U.S.-born, which is a new euphemism for an American citizen. Most of us are American citizens by virtue of the fact that we're U.S.-born. To be U.S.-born means you're an American citizen. Of course, there's other ways to be an American citizen, but that is one automatic way. And so he's an American citizen, which means he's entitled to all the protections that the Constitution affords to citizens against the government that everybody else, including the nice family down the street, is entitled to. He was educated in the United States and became a Muslim cleric. And interestingly, the government valued him as a moderate Muslim in the aftermath of 9/11. They actually invited him to a luncheon where they featured him as somebody who could bridge the gap between the American government and extremists in the Muslim community. The Washington Post provided him a forum to host chats on the Washington Post website after 9/11, where he educated people about the meaning of Muslim festivals and holidays and rituals and the like. So he was deemed a moderate Muslim, somebody who could actually be favorable to the United States because of his American background. And he became basically, as a lot of people did, increasingly radicalized over the last decade as the United States began slaughtering huge numbers of Muslim men, women, and children in multiple countries around the world. And he became a very ardent opponent of U.S. policy and began sermonizing that Muslims had not only the right but the duty to defend themselves against American aggression by essentially engaging in jihad against American military installations and soldiers and the like. And because he speaks English, because he understands American culture, the sermon started really resonating with large parts of the English-speaking Muslim world, and the U.S. government became preoccupied with depicting him as this grave threat, not because of anything he was doing, but because of the ideas that he was effectively expressing. And when it got reported that he was on President Obama's hit list, a hit list created by President Obama of American citizens who were ordered to be killed by the U.S. military or the CIA, they realized they couldn't justify killing an American citizen because they were giving sermons that the government disliked. So they started claiming, with no evidence presented and anonymously, mostly, to the media, that he actually now had an operational role in terrorist plots. And that's the claim that now is being cited to justify his due process-free murder by the U.S. government, even though no evidence has been presented, there's been no indictment in a court, or any other procedures invoked before the government can punish any citizen, let alone kill them.
Now, all right, let's back up here. Awlaki's father actually went to court. This is almost the beginning of the year, was it at the end of last year, to basically say, hey, please don't kill my son. Please don't put him on
right.
this list.
Went into court and asked the court to enjoin President Obama from killing his son without due process. That was the remedy sought by that lawsuit.
You know, it's stunning because, you know, you say that and it literally reads like an Onion article. You know what I mean? That this is like the Onion in, you know, theoretically, unfortunately it's now, but it's one of those sort of futuristic Onion articles. Please don't, unconstitutionally kill my family. Well, you're going to have to sue us, and you may lose in court on that. Yeah, I mean, what – all right, so
So when did they make this
change? Well, let me just say one thing about that lawsuit. What's most amazing about that lawsuit is, I mean, the Obama administration could have gone in at any time to a court and indicted Alaki if they believed he was guilty of terrorist crimes and had evidence to prove it. They didn't do that. So they got brought into court involuntarily by the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights representing Alaki's father, and they could have then told the judge, look, here's our evidence to justify, to prove the truth of our accusation that he's plotting operationally to attack the United States. Instead of doing that, they invoked all the standard Bush-Cheney procedural arguments about why the president has the unilateral choice to target people as enemy combatants without the court's interference, and they even claimed that whom the president identifies as a terrorist and targets for assassination is a state secret that no court can examine. So rather than presenting the evidence once they were in court to justify their accusations that he's a terrorist, they hid behind secrecy claims, broad radical secrecy claims, in order to avoid doing that. Ultimately, the court dismissed the suit on the grounds that Alaki's father didn't have standing to sue on his behalf. Alaki had to do it himself. Of course, the reason Alaki didn't do it is because he knew that the minute he stuck his head up to represent, to get through the ACLU representing him or to go into court, he would be targeted and killed. But the court, you know, disregarded that kind of catch-22 and said, I don't have to decide this because Alaki's father has no standing to raise his rights. Alaki himself has to do it.
Right. That's the easy way out for the court. Now, this is an interesting thing. Now, I've interviewed Charlie Savage on his essay that he's written about the distinction between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. It's going on Ring of Fire. We're going to play it on this program next week. But what's interesting about this is, you know, he makes the case that the Bush administration essentially entered into its administration with a full-on agenda to expand the executive's power prior to even 9/11. 9/11 just provided more sort of like, I guess, fodder for that machine, as it were. Whereas the Obama administration is simply trying to create a structure of a rule of law. We may not appreciate the laws that they're creating, but they may have be problematic from a civil libertarian standpoint, but they're trying to create a framework. But this doesn't fit in with that, does it? I mean, this is really more about, like you say, they have the opportunity to say, this guy is guilty of X, Y, and Z. This is why we're killing him. You may disagree with our findings, but these are our findings. But they're not even making that case. They're not even trying to justify it other than on the grounds of we're the presidency or we're the executive branch. We don't have to really tell you why we're doing this.
Well, the interesting thing about Charlie Savage's essay is that he does draw this distinction between, there were sort of two aspects to why civil libertarians criticized the Bush administration. One was because they were out doing these horrible things in violation of the law, based on the idea that the president has the ability to disregard the law. The other aspect was, whether the law allows it or not, these things are horrible, right? Whether the law allows it or not, it's wrong to put people in prison for years without charges. It's wrong to torture people, it's wrong to eavesdrop on their calls without warrants, even if the law allows it. So it's sort of a bifurcated criticism.
And let me just explain to people, when we say the law allows it, the law is elastic, particularly on this level, because it's being interpreted by internal lawyers who say, this is legal, this is not legal. So there's a certain elasticity, at least on that level, when they start to apply the law.
True, but what really started happening, and it really happened in the Bush administration, the second term of the Bush administration, was they just, you know, the first term of the Bush administration was them doing whatever they wanted without even asking Congress to approve it. And what was weird about that was, you know, Congress was even more submissive than normal in the wake of 9/11 and would have done anything the Bush administration asked them to do. But rather than ask permission from the Congress, they just went and did whatever they wanted to do, even when Congress had passed laws saying you can't do this, like eavesdropping on Americans' calls without warrants. And yet in the second term of the administration, what you saw was the Bush administration going to Congress and asking Congress to approve of the things that it was doing. So Congress in 2008 passed the FISA Amendments Act and Protect America Act that allowed them to eavesdrop on Americans' calls without warrants. It passed the Military Commissions Act that allowed them to imprison people without due process. So this idea of taking these excesses of the war on terror and codifying it in law really began with the Bush administration. And then it did did continue in the Obama administration. Ironically, that's a reason why President Obama has, as lots of people have argued, including former Bush lawyers, has actually strengthened the Bush-Cheney approach to terrorism beyond what even Bush and Cheney did, because he made it the bipartisan consensus of both parties and grounded it in the law, rather than just making it the sort of ad hoc view of the administration. But as you just said, and as Charlie Savage pointed out, there's now recent developments that show that Obama is abandoning that adherence to the rule of law and relying on these really broad claims of executive power. The most, you know, egregious example was the argument that he could wage the war in Libya in violation of the War Powers Act, and that even once Congress voted against authorizing that war, that the president has the authority to simply continue waging war in Libya without any authorization from Congress. And you're absolutely right. This extrajudicial targeting of Iwaki is a perfect example. This is the post I just wrote, actually, that's about to be up, if not for Salon's great new system, that says that the idea of what justified, the mindset that justified the Bush war on terror excesses was the idea that we're at war, these are terrorists that we're doing these things to. We know they're terrorists not because the government has presented evidence in court to show it, or not because a court has accepted a finding of a terrorist. We know it because the government says they are, and we can trust that and believe it. And then once the government accuses someone of being a terrorist, anything the president wants to do is justifiable in order to eradicate terrorists. That is exactly the mindset that is being used by Obama defenders to justify what was done to Iwaki. No trials are needed. No evidence need to be presented because he's a bad terrorist. I know this because my president told me. And that is the very expression of a lawless, unrestrained executive, the ability not just to imprison citizens without due process like Bush did, not just to eavesdrop on them without judicial oversight the way Bush did, but to kill them without due process or oversight the way Obama is doing. And the same mentality, this lawless, unrestrained executive power, is absolutely the one on which people are relying to defend what the president did.
Now, when we talk about, you know, it's one thing, well, I mean, I'm not excusing any part of this, but I just want to break it down here. So the president says, this guy is a terrorist, therefore we have the right to kill him because there's some justification. We can get into whether or not the authorization, the AUMF that was passed in 2001, he would even fall under this rubric because the organization that we claim that he belongs to didn't even exist at that time. But aside from that, does the government have any definition of terrorism, or terrorists, I should say? Because, you know, it's one thing they're saying, like, oh, we can only kill terrorists. He's a terrorist. But if there's not even a measure of what makes a terrorist, we can't even say whether or not he's being properly codified as that. I mean, they've taken out every step of the way in which one would have a rule of law. Not only can we argue that their determination on the facts is incorrect, but we can't even argue their determination based on the facts because we don't know what they use to create those categories. In other words, am I a terrorist if I start saying I'm pro Occupy Wall Street and the government just randomly decides these people are terrorists?
Well, this is, you know, one of the more amazing aspects of what the government is doing in general and specifically with regard to terrorism. I mean, there are legal memoranda that were produced, for example, during the Bush years that justified everything that President Bush was doing. And those legal memoranda were kept secret. And this is one of the great scandals of the Bush administration, was that basically when the Justice Department creates memoranda that justifies what the president's doing, and that's kept secret, basically living under secret law. I mean, not just that the operations and intelligence activities of the U.S. government are secret, but that the legal justifications, the law, is itself secret, which is an extraordinary thing for in a democracy. Well, there is a memoranda that the Obama Justice Department wrote, apparently, justifying the killing of Iwaki that also has been kept secret. So we don't know their justification, we don't know their rationale, any more than we know the evidence that they're pointing to justify what was done. But the broader point is the one that you touched on, which is, if you look at most of what is done of a controversial nature by the president in a foreign policy terrorism context, at the center of it is the accusation that this person is a terrorist. If you utter that word terrorist, it paralyzes the citizenry. They literally, if the government points at somebody and utters the word terrorist, huge hordes of people will start screaming, kill him. It's like a trained response. And all rational dialogue shuts down. If this person's a terrorist, who would possibly oppose putting them in prison or eavesdropping on them or killing them? This is how our political discourse works. And what's most amazing about that is that this word that's the center of our political discourse and our legal theories, terrorism, is a word for which there is no objective agreed upon definition. It simply is it's simply a word without a definition. And this has been the case since the early 1970s when the Israelis started trying to popularize the idea that the enemies that they were facing, like the PLO, were the same enemies as the West was facing. And the word terrorism was sort of created as the all-encompassing term. And the problem with it is that no matter what definition you come up with, it doesn't achieve what you want to achieve. So, for example, if you try and say that terrorism is the deliberate targeting of civilians, the killing of civilians for political ends, well, you know, the United States did exactly that with the Shock and Awe campaign in Baghdad. We purposely terrorized that population into trying to submit. The Israelis do that all the time in Gaza. They did it in Lebanon. And yet at the same time, when Muslims engage in violence against American military targets, like when Afghan citizens fight back against American troops that are occupying their country, or when, for example, Nidal Hassan went on a military base and shot at service members who were deploying to war, or when the Muslim who was just arrested last week for supposedly plotting to send model airplanes into the Pentagon, when they plot to attack military targets, those are immediately called terrorists. This is a word that has no fixed meaning. It basically is a manipulated, meaningless word that the U.S. government invokes to basically describe any of its enemies and to justify whatever we want to do against them. You know, these games have been played for so long. Whenever we want to put a leader who we don't like to demonize them, we put them on the terrorist list like we did with Saddam Hussein. In the early 1980s, when we want to support them, we take them off like we did with Saddam, when we wanted to fund him and send him arms and money to fight against Iran, and then when we don't like him anymore, they go back on the list. It's a game-playing term of propaganda that really has no fixed meaning, and what's so amazing about that is it drives most of not just what the government does, but how people think about what the government does.
Yeah, this part of it is so stunning to me, because you are killing someone in this instance who is an American citizen because you are labeling him a terrorist. And of course, that is an accusation. You don't have to prove it. And even if you did have to prove it, there's no standard on which to prove it against. So there's so many different fictions that are sort of brought in here, or so many things that we are supposed to simply accept as truths that have no even... There's not even a there's not even an attempt by the administration to provide a kangaroo court or a kangaroo ruling or anything that can even be trumpeted in this way. There's no definition of terrorism. There's no claim that they have secret information that meets this definition of terrorism. You can't even ask as to why this American citizen's been put on this list, because that in and of itself is secret. There's so many different layers here, and it's stunning to me that it just passes by with very little sort of, I guess, outcry, short of yourself and maybe a couple other writers. I just can't get beyond that.
I can't either. I mean, think about the things that we're inculcated with when we're children. I mean, I remember all the time being taught that the difference between the system of government in the United States, the free democratic system we enjoy, and tyranny in the Soviet Union and elsewhere, is that the government does not have the power to imprison its citizens without charging them with the crime and proving beyond a reasonable doubt in a court that they're actually guilty. That in other countries and prior monarchies, the king had the power to decree someone's guilt without a trial. This is really one of the principal handful of distinguishing features that we're taught distinguishes our country from tyrannies and authoritarian governments. And yet, you really do have huge numbers of people. I mean, in the Bush years, you had Republicans. Now, under a Democratic president, you have Republicans and Democrats cheering for, justifying, defending the idea that the president has the power in secret to target individual American citizens for death, for execution, to be the judge, jury, and executioner far away from any battlefield. I mean, obviously, if an American citizen is on a battlefield fighting against the American military, they can be killed just like any other member of a foreign military engaged in active combat. This is not that situation in any way, shape, or form. The kill order is he shall be killed if he's found in his car, in his home, at work, on the street, wherever. And if you justify that power, the power of the president to target American citizens for death with no due process, then it really is impossible to imagine what power you would object to the president exercising. I mean, that is the most, that is the ultimate and the most extreme power that exists.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's no, and there's no way in which you could argue against this, because they're saying that we don't, even beyond they're saying that we have the right to this power, we don't even have to justify the why we have this power beyond saying a couple of words that are meaningless. I mean, you know, there was a I spoke to the documentary filmmaker of this movie about the Earth Liberation Front, which was a so-called eco-terrorist group that was more active certainly in the late 90s, early 2000. One guy was arrested 3 or 5 years later in New York. They had committed arsons in the name of environmental action. They were listed by the FBI as the number one domestic terrorist group. And one wonders, honestly, how I, for instance, if I felt that people should, if I use this microphone to go and say people should be taking this type of direct violent action towards people and ended it there, how I would not be eligible to be killed by our government. I mean, I don't see how, where in that process the line could be crossed, because there are no lines anymore.
There is no way to distinguish that. And let me just say this. You know, I remember, because I was arguing about these issues every day with Bush supporters during the Bush years, that their ultimate mindset that led them not to be bothered by the things that were being done and to justify them was the idea that they would ultimately admit that these powers were subject to abuse. I mean, how could you not admit that the power to imprison American citizens on U.S. soil with no due process is subject to abuse, or that spying on people's calls with no judicial oversight is subject to abuse? They would admit that these things were subject to abuse, but they would basically fall back on the idea that they trusted George Bush as the president not to abuse these powers, and that he would only exercise them truly in order to deter terrorists and to attack terrorists. And so rather than try and use this theoretical argument that human beings are subject to temptations to abuse power in secret, it's inevitably done, including George Bush, the argument a lot of civil libertarians, including me, would make was, okay, well, think about the fact that if you justify this power because there's a leader that you currently trust, this power is going to exist when there's a new leader from the Democratic Party whom you don't trust. So imagine Hillary Clinton, for example, with the power to spy on your calls without warrants or to put you in prison without any due charge, without any due process or charges. Isn't that a power that you should want to oppose so that it doesn't get institutionalized, so that a leader you don't trust can end up using it? And this is the same argument that Obama supporters are now falling back upon, which is they're comfortable with having the current leader target American citizens for murder without due process, because they're comfortable that he's a good person who won't abuse that power and will use it in the proper ways. Leaving aside how inane and childish that trust is, and how un-American that trust in a president is to exercise power in secret, what about Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann or Newt Gingrich or some other president who, when they succeed President Obama, and there will be a president after President Obama, and there will be a Republican president at some point in the future, who now has the power, because of these Obama supporters, to target American citizens for death with no due process based on the claim that they're a terrorist? How will they possibly object when that happens, given that it will be their fault? And the other thing that you point out is exactly correct. Because the idea of terrorism is so elastic, and all of this is done in secret, there are already examples of the U.S. government taking powers justified in the name of terrorism and applying them to an extraordinarily wide array of activity, including protest movements on American soil, peace groups, those who dissent in all sorts of ways. The Patriot Act has been used. The FBI has used lots of its post 9/11 investigative authorities to investigate and scrutinize not quote-unquote terrorists of the kind that we think of, people trying to put bombs in American buildings or on airplanes, but American political groups that are engaged in some sort of dissent and protest. People who are in authority view anyone who threatens their authority as a terrorist. That is what a terrorist is. People who meaningfully deter or oppose or subvert the power of the people who are or are the current authorities. This has been true throughout all of history. That's how the word terrorism is used. That's how the word enemy of the state is always used. So if you justify the idea that the president can murder terrorists without due process, and terrorist is whoever the president says a terrorist is, you are guaranteeing, it's not likely, it's a guarantee that at some point in the future, either this president or some subsequent president will use that authority to target people who are engaged in serious dissent domestically. There's no way to draw a line. There is no intellectual or theoretical distinction between justifying the murder of a citizen in Yemen by the president's order, unilateral order, and allowing him to do it on American soil.
Right. There, I mean, and that's that. That there is no, there is absolutely no structure to any of this. Glenn, we're out of time, but this is exactly why we talk about having a nation of laws and not of men, because now we've essentially obliterated all of the laws that go into this decision, and there's no accountability, and there is no way to draw that distinction down the road. You're absolutely right. Glenn Greenwald, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Sam. Good to be here.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to our guy on Occupy Wall Street. For all we know, could be considered a potential future terrorist. Maybe there is a category. For all we know, it would be secret, of course. You can't know because it would be a state secret. It would be bad for you to know. Believe us. Trust us. These potential future terrorists are just as dangerous as the existing terrorists. We have a whole legal framework that we can't tell you about the potential future terrorists. Maybe we have one on the phone in just a moment. We're going to take a break when we come back. And we will come back to a sound that Matt took at the Friday protest. And Matt, on the better half of the show, will also tell us his experiences. But first, we're going to go to our guy, Jeff, live from Occupy Wall Street. We'll be right back. Are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That is sound that Matt took from Friday as people marched to One Police Plaza in New York City. We are the 99%, and one of those 99%ers is on the phone with us now. Jeff, just down from his media perch overlooking Zuccotti Park, or now known as Liberty Square, by the occupiers of Wall Street. Jeff, welcome to the program. Jeff, you there?
Actually, yeah, I am here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, good. Actually, Allison Kilkenny on today's Citizen Radio mentioned that Zuccotti Park is the park's slave name, and that we'd like to refer to it as Liberty Plaza from now on. So
fantastic. I see you've made up for the trouble that you caused on Friday. Now, Jeff was with us on Friday, and the Citizen Radio people, Jamie, very, very sensitive about your comments, saying that the people down at the park were bigger fans of the Majority Report than Citizen Radio.
I know, and you know, they sort of took me to task on their show today, and I'd just like to point out to Jamie and Allison and the rest of the Citizen Radio listeners that one of the things that grown-ups do is sometimes they kid each other. It's called teasing. I think Jamie's from New Jersey. He might know it as breaking balls. But nobody's serious about the fact that Citizen Radio and the Majority Report are not on the same side of this whole thing. And Allison's been down here covering it from the beginning, and everyone knows that. So just relax.
You know, the thing, Jamie is actually, I think, vying for a Marc Maron WTF Pod Award. He's going to get the Marc Maron Thin Skin Award soon. And on Thursday, I think we're going to be doing a show together from Liberty Plaza. And I hope I don't spend the whole time teasing Jamie. This is bad. Once I smell blood like that, it's always a problem. But all right, so Jeff, you sent me a great email giving me an update of what you'd seen since Friday, and I figured, you know what, why read it when I can have you talk about it? Why don't you start with Friday? There was a rumor that Radiohead was going to be playing in the park. Turned out to be not the case. But what happened around that time?
Well, we had obviously a huge influx of people. A lot of them were here for Radiohead, and what we've seen in a lot of cases when people just show up here for media celebrities or something other than the protest, we always end up peeling off, you know, a certain percentage, and they become part of this movement as well. And so by 5 o'clock, when it was evident that there was no concert to be had here, everyone was ready to go on a scheduled march, and it ended up with sizably larger numbers, and they walked down to One Police Plaza. As a precaution, they decided to make it a silent march just because there were so many new people that had joined, and they didn't want the police to have an excuse to perpetrate any violence on them. And if you noticed, it ended up on the front page of the New York Times on Saturday morning. So
yeah, quite huge. I mean, how many thousands of people were there on Friday?
I mean, at its largest, the park was really pushing capacity. I'd say upwards of 10,000 people. And the march itself down towards One Police Plaza was probably 3,000, 4,000, maybe even 5,000 people. It was enormous.
Yeah, we just played some sound from it. I mean, it's stunning, stunning sound. So, and then that night, people came back from the plaza to have a general assembly, and this was amazing. You had close to 1,500 people there. And what happened with the people's mic? That's, I mean, a reminder for people, there's no amplification allowed in the park, and so people use this people's mic. One person says a phrase, it's repeated by the people around them. How did that work out?
Well, what happened was we actually had to install people as repeaters various spots throughout the crowd so that it could kind of reverberate from one group to the next to the next. So the speakers would have to wait, honestly, for it to be repeated 3, 4, 5 times. And it was almost like an aural wave that you could hear kind of wash across this huge crowd. It was pretty cool.
Wow. And just, you know, give us a sense of what type of things are discussed at the General Assembly. I know we've talked about this before, but for our new listeners, people who are just tuning into what's going on with this, what is discussed at the General Assembly?
Well, there are really two types of things, I suppose. One is more about logistics in terms of scheduling meetings and talking about upcoming events or dealing with security or blankets or things of that nature. And the other is really more a political process and the different working groups, particularly the ones that are trying to craft messages, whether it's for creating outreach stations to draw more people in or direct action and actually planning out some of the protests. Even a group has popped up now that's specifically about political reform. And what they do is they work on their own in these subcommittees, and then they bring it to the General Assembly, and they sort of offer it up to the general group. So
So there's now a group
here.
There's now a subgroup that is actually talking about reforming the political process at Liberty Plaza.
That's correct.
Wow. Okay.
And it's really interesting because there's a member of the legal team here I spoke to. Her name is Marissa Citron. She was actually on Democracy Now, and she wrote a book about the movement in Argentina that really started about 10 years ago, and talked about how similar really the structure of what's going on at the General Assembly is to them. And her book, you know, talks about horizontal. It's a horizontalidad or whatever the Argentinian word is. But it's about a horizontal structure as opposed to a vertical structure. And what we're seeing now is that with all the satellite movements popping up around the country, I could very easily see this turn into a way where we create almost a parallel political process and organization instead of, you know, trying to be co-opted into the current system. So if we could really organize the people in a way that is on a local level and then comes to a general consensus overall, that becomes a real force and a real power. And so I think as a process, this whole movement is feeling like it's starting to take a shape. And even a week ago, I think I didn't know where this was going or what was going to happen. But it's really starting to get interesting.
It's fascinating because there are over 100 of Facebook groups of Occupy, Chicago, Boston, Wall Street, local towns, and several hundred thousand people have already signed up and liked themselves and you know, and have sort of tuned into this. So this is growing both at an accelerated pace and in an accelerated sort of scope. But let's get back to what you experienced on Saturday, because you were one of those guys on the bridge who were
they call us the frontline reporters, by the way.
Yes.
Guys that are actually out there for any of our Citizen Radio listeners. That's what we call them.
Oh, God. Let's not plug Citizen Radio too much. Now I'm going to get offended. We're going to...
Sorry about that.
The politics of just the podcast wars are tough on and on. Whoops. Oh, hi, folks. Time is up. We're going to have to... for those of you who are not members of the show, sorry, we're going to have to say goodbye to you now. You can become a member at majority.fm. This interview is going to go on for another 10 minutes. In fact, I know it did because this is after the fact. But please support the program. Become a member, 33 cents a day. It allows us to do this work, get out in front of stories like this, spread it to the corporate media, and all these great interviews. So just go to majority.fm, become a member a day, 10 bucks a month, folks. It's nothing. Keep the show alive. And, of course, you can always support the show by going to justcoffee.coop, buying coffee, tea, or chocolate, fair trade, organic, co-op, coupon code majority, save 10%. And tomorrow on the program, David Dayan, Mike Stark. It's going to be a great week of programming. Why not hear all of it by becoming a member? Thanks for joining us.